people who are in the very earliest stages of dementia are more likely to take sleep medications, causing an apparent risk. However, the evidence is mounting that certain medicines, those with anticholinergic properties, may indeed predispose people to dementia. This group includes many over-the-counter sleep medicines, such as those containing diphenhydramine. I don't recommend these for regular use. I try not to prescribe sleeping medicines at all. I don't know of any sleep medication that is both completely safe and highly effective. Many people do well with sleep hygiene techniques. Melatonin does not seem to increase risk of dementia or falls, but it does not work for many people.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 76 and mostly cloudy. Tonight it will be cloudy with a low in the low 60s. Then tomorrow partly cloudy with a high in the mid-70s. Tomorrow night it will be cloudy with a low in the mid-60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
Hello and welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This week I'm covering our fourth reading from the May issue of Entertainment Weekly. We started kind of early into this issue because of the Oscars, and it had an Oscar cover story and it was super timely. But it feels strange that it's only mid-month and we're already into our fourth episode. So let's take a look at what we've got. I'm starting with your editor's letter, the weekly dispatch that I get through email. I didn't love everything about being a teen, especially not the braces or general awkwardness of the days before I learned how to style my hair. But I love everything about television shows about teens. Over on EW.com, we've launched I Want My Teen TV, a summer-long initiative dedicated to the magical genre that is teen television. From May to August, we'll be putting out new content about some of our favorite shows. We've already kicked things off with a list of the 50 best teen shows of all time, a story talking to writers about the appeal and evolution of the genre, and a list of underrated gems you might have missed. Like most teenagers, we have a lot of feels on the topic, so be sure to check out all our coverage for the next few months. No pressure, but all the cool kids are doing it. What's your favorite teen show of all time? Until next week, Sam. And you can send her a Twitter, you can tweet her, I guess, at @SamHighfill, SamHighfill. Here are five things to say at a virtual party. The best and worst news of the week. Number one, Hulu releases the first photo of Lily James as Pamela Anderson, causing people everywhere to Google, what does Lily James normally look like? Number two, Grey's Anatomy has been renewed for season 18, because Meredith hasn't been through enough, apparently. Number three, the Venom sequel trailer shows the villain is willing to kill for chocolate, making him the most relatable symbiote in history. Number four, Elon Musk was funnier than expected on Saturday Night Live. Said no one. And number five, who had the Golden Globes canceled on their 2021 bingo card? For what to watch, all your TV dilemmas sorted. On May 7th on Amazon, The Underground Railroad came out. Barry Jenkins directs the series about Cora, played by Thuso Mberu, a young woman attempting to break free from slavery in the Deep South. High School Musical, the series. That's out May 14th on Disney Plus. It makes for a terrible hashtag, but a pretty entertaining show, and it's back for season two. The MTV Movie and TV Awards on May 14th on MTV. Nothing will top Ryan Gosling and Rachel McAdams' 2005 kiss, but it's still worth watching. NCIS New Orleans, May 16th on CBS. After seven seasons, NCIS New Orleans will bid farewell with its series finale. And binge Felicity. This is on Hulu. Carrie Russell and Carrie Russell's hair leads this classic teen series about college, love, and the journey to find oneself. We don't have a special guest editor this week in our email, but we do have a column called Feedback We Asked, You Answered, because in some of the recent emails, they have included an email address for feedback. The question was, what's your recent sci-fi series? And here, somebody named George A. Gessner is saying, my favorite is Resident Alien. It's kind of like Psych meets X-Files in a Twin Peaks setting, great writing, and three-dimensional characters. Allison Walford says, Resident Alien. And then Ron Bass says, The Expanse is, without a doubt, one of the best written and produced science fiction shows in many years. It provides great characters, an alternate view of the future, and a strong storyline. That was our editor's letter, the weekly email that I get. And I think later on in the show today, we'll start to look at that list of teen shows, the top 50, but that article is way too long. So I think I'll dip into it a little bit every week for the next few weeks. Now I'm going to the magazine and one of our feature stories. In fact, I think it's the last feature story we have from the May issue. It's called Stand Up and Step Up. For Entertainment Weekly's Around the Table, Chloe Bennett, Diane Doan, Daniel Day-Kim, Harry Kondabolu, Olivia Munn, and George Takei discuss the rise in violence against Asians, their experiences as Asian artists, and how Hollywood can help crush stereotypes and be more inclusive. This is by Rachel Yang. A wave of hatred. That's what recent attacks on Asians in America have felt like to many. Cases of hate crimes and discrimination totaled nearly 3,800 from March 2020 to February 2021 per Stop AAPI Hate. And just 2 days after our roundtable in mid-March, a gunman in the Atlanta area killed 8 people, 6 of them Asian women. These tragedies have motivated stars to fight back. Daniel Day-Kim from New Amsterdam was one of the first to condemn such attacks at the start of the pandemic. Then in February, he and actor Daniel Wu offered a $25,000 reward to help find the assailant of an elderly Oakland man. Olivia Munn from X-Men Apocalypse also jumped into action, amplifying causes and speaking out. Many more have followed suit. Entertainment Weekly gathered 6 Asian stars to discuss their Hollywood experiences, the minority quota when it comes to roles, and how the industry and world can support Asian communities. In the first category, on attacks against Asians, Daniel Day-Kim says, I was heartbroken. I was frustrated. I was exasperated and I was angry. And I still am all of those things. Anyone who cares about this issue cannot be numb to the propensity and the frequency of these attacks. It's happening all over the country, and it doesn't seem to be abating. George Takei says, This is not a current phenomenon. Violence against Asians is as old as American history. It was that has-been president who constantly used the phrase Chinese flu, Wuhan flu, or Kung flu, that caused uneducated people to take it out on the most fragile, vulnerable people in the community, the elderly. They are cowards, and cowards are throughout American history. Chloe Bennett says, We can't really address the racism that's happening toward Asian Americans without addressing the racism that is happening toward African Americans or our Latinx brothers and sisters. It's a really, really complicated situation. This past year has really shifted my understanding of my place and how I can help everyone. There are so many Asian American groups and advocacy organizations that are putting in the work, but really just need to be amplified. Olivia Munn says, It's not that I didn't know about what was happening to our people before the pandemic. It's that the culture within, even for me, somebody who is very outspoken about things, it felt like I would be screaming into an echo chamber. To see Daniel, that's Dae Kim, and Daniel Wu speak up and do it so eloquently, and then also get that response back, we do need people in our own community to step up and stand up and say, okay, we're going to address this. And Diane Doan says, I'm checking in with my family, trying to find what modes of protection they can carry, especially my mother, teaching them it's okay to speak up. My mother's mentality is like, well, if something happens to you, you must have done something. What did you do? And it's reversing that stigma. It's reversing that immigrant, I'm just happy to be here mentality. On the Crazy Rich Asians effect, Bennett says, representation is more important now than ever. It's having stories told that are authentic and having the people on screen and, equally as important, off screen telling those stories. Munn says, we need people who are in decision-making positions to want to do something more than just make money. We have to understand our position in this world when we have the largest platform in the world and the largest megaphone to reach out to so many different countries and people. We have to have people who are in those positions wanting to make a change, and also knowing what can and does come with a big monetary reward as well. Harry Kondabolu says, also, the recent success of Asians and South Asians and increased roles. Part of it, of course, is due to the activism of our communities over decades, pushing for things and countering stereotypical things and media and challenging them. But the other part, like what Olivia said, is money. People finally figured out, oh, their communities have money too, and they want to spend it? If you want the numbers, you have the numbers globally. Crazy Rich Asians was a huge film. There's so many films that have yet to be made, and our stories are your new stories because you didn't let us talk until 5 years ago. On the minority quota, Kondabolu says, the idea that people are going to say, why do we need another one? Why do we need 48 Transformers movies? I thought Hollywood's whole thing is milking the same thing over and over until it's dead. Kim says, I think it's fair to say that Hollywood operates under a fear-based decision-making system and people don't want to take chances because they're afraid to lose their jobs. They want to do what they know. If the decision-makers are all white males, then they're going to greenlight the projects that appeal to them. And that's why it's so important to have people who are not white or not male in those decision-making processes. It's about pushing the boundaries in your respective fields. Whether it's acting, directing, producing, or all of the above, do whatever you're able to do to push this boundary. Keep this as part of your agenda because that's the only way it's going to get further. The people who are just starting in this business are not in positions like we are where we can make change and ask for things on a daily basis in the jobs that we have. So it's up to those of us who can to do. And that's how a wave gets formed. Bennett says, the reality is the white people are not going to make room for us. It's going to be us that has to. We have to show up, take up space, and be good. White guys can show up and be incredibly mediocre, and it doesn't matter. We don't have room to be mediocre. Diane and I played sisters on Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and it's not a coincidence that our showrunner is an Asian-American woman. They cast me, and they could have completely not played into me being half Chinese, and instead they leaned into it. That would not have happened if Marisa Tichiron was not leading the show. I want to be so good and take up so much space as a community that we get to be as mediocre as those white guys. Bun says, I've heard it many times when I throw out an actor's name and they say, we've hit our minority quota with you. And I'm like, I didn't bring up this person's name because they're a minority. I brought them up because they're a really talented actor. And that is really dehumanizing for sure. Doan says, as recent as last year, it was, oh, we'd love to meet you. You're hot right now. Then going into the room and them finding out that I'm a Vietnamese Canadian, they're like, oh, we're looking for a certain type of Asian. So if you, by any chance, take a 23andMe in the next 24 hours and find out you're 100% Chinese, give us a call. I'm not joking. Bennett says, when I first moved to L.A., a casting director was like, you're not white enough for the lead, but you're not Asian enough for the best friend. I remember absorbing that as a 17-year-old and being like, she's right, because there was no Asian lead female like that at the time. I'm Chloe Wang. I lived in China. I speak Mandarin, but it's not everything. What white people don't realize is that they don't have to be reduced to this one facet of themselves constantly or put into this box. I used my dad's first name, Bennett, for one audition, and then it propelled me in a direction. I've struggled with that self-whitewashing of myself, to be honest, for a while, because nothing about me changed, only the people's perception of me in the room, in that moment. And that worked. That feeling is something I never want other Chloe Wangs to feel. On Being Thrown Out to the Wolves, Doan says, on my show Warrior, as an Asian woman character in a position of power or wanting power automatically becomes the villain. Experiencing those comments from the audience of, well, she's a bitch, or she's power hungry, or she's evil. Why is that? Bennett says, it's like these in-between moments where you're thrown out to the wolves. A lot of that had to do with being a woman. A lot of that had to do with being a young woman of color. You're freaking sprinting a marathon blind. You're trying to figure out your resources, your community, how to respond. It's scary. Kim says, that's also called blazing a trail because there's no path in front of you. I remember what happened with Kelly Marie Tran and the Star Wars movies. Tran was the target of racist and sexist attacks after she became the first Asian American woman to star in a Star Wars movie, The Last Jedi. Mun says, it goes back to the psyche of people that it's okay to go after Asians and it's okay to make fun of us, that the hate crimes that are perpetrated against us are okay, and we have to keep swallowing it. And what happened to her was devastating to watch, and it was devastating to hear how quiet people were about it. If you are anti-racist, then you need to also be upset about what's happening to Asian Americans. It doesn't make sense if you're doing it just when it's trendy. In the last category, on firsts in Hollywood, Kim says, I want to see the first non-first. I would love to see it where there's so many of us, and I'm not talking about Asian Americans, but just everyone of all shapes and sizes, who are getting their turn in the spotlight, and there's a true diversity of portrayal and representation that we don't ever have to talk about this. And George Takei says, the Starship Enterprise's makeup should be the reality of our society, Starship Earth. That was Stand Up, Step Up by Rachel Yang. And there's a list of resources here. There's Stop AAPI Hate. Their website is stopaapihate.org. Little Tokyo Service Center. Their website is ltsc.org. Compassion in Oakland. That's compassioninoakland.org. AAPI Community Fund. That's gofundme.com/c/act/stop-AAPI-hate. And there's a PBS docuseries called Asian Americans. Next, I'm going over to the movies section of the magazine, and here is a Q&A. It's called Bad Romance. Amanda Seyfried and James Norton talk about their tragically doomed marriage in Netflix's Things Heard and Seen. That was out April 29th, and this is by Lauren Huff. In the wild supernatural cum marriage drama Things Heard and Seen, James Norton from Little Women and Amanda Seyfried from Mank play George and Catherine Clare, a young couple who move upstate New York and discover that their marriage harbors a sinister darkness not unlike the history of their new home. The actors, both 35, gathered to discuss the allure and unique challenge of working on the trippy 80s set film. The first question is, what about this appealed to you? James Norton says, to me, the draw was the relationship. They're a progressive couple in a sense, for the time, in that they both have jobs. And George, there's a certain sort of struggle where, being the weak man that he is, he feels like his wife's strength disempowers him. And that's not the case, as we know. So there's something inherently interesting there. For me, the relationship between the two of them, it wasn't an out-and-out horror, as much as a psychological thriller with this incredibly nuanced and rich relationship at the center of it. Amanda Seyfried says, I mean, that's the thing. It's so hard to categorize this movie in any one genre because, yes, there's supernatural elements. Yes, it feels sometimes like a horror movie, but there's depth to it that exists in the marriage. And it's something I could relate to and something I feel the audiences can relate to. The next question is, was it difficult to balance the tone between domestic drama and thriller? And Norton says, all of that horror stuff did feel sort of secondary. Whenever we had any conversation, which was specifically ghost-related, it was always in relation to how it was kind of pushing these characters to more extreme versions of themselves. And that's what good horror does. It's not just the jump for its own sake. Seyfried says, I gotta say, it's much harder as I get older. I hope it's not me losing my instincts as an actor, but when you're feeling you're in a safe place and you have no one else on set with you, you feel so safe. It's much harder to imagine that there's an entity in the room that makes you unsafe. That was really hard. And in watching those scenes back, I'm like, oh God, special effects have come so far. But I know what's coming. And so playing the ghost and metaphysical aspects of each scene was just so much harder than I thought it was going to be. I still don't enjoy watching the scenes of me doing that because I'm like, oh man, why couldn't I have been a child there? And the last question is, what do you hope the audience takes away from the film? Seyfried says, the experience of second-guessing your instincts and being gaslit. I want us to feel like the marriage is the first terrifying element and the heart of the terror, but also, with dynamics between people in your life, you can so easily feel like you can't find solid ground. People like George make you second-guess your instincts. For me, the takeaway as an audience member is to, when in doubt, always trust your instincts. You're born with them, and they're there for a reason. Do not allow anybody else to take your power and control away. Norton says, there is a real provocative angle to this about power dynamics and relationships, both now and then, and particularly when it comes to women in that relationship, taking her space and the man reacting very, very badly. That's a conversation I hope people will have afterwards. But I also hope they enjoy it because it's fun. It's a great thing to watch late at night with your partner. You can get jumpy. And Seyfried finishes with, and ideally, people will be like, what the F just happened? That was a Q&A, Bad Romance, and it was by Lauren Huff. Our next story is called Childlike Wonder. Golden Globe-nominated actor David Oyelowo goes behind the camera for his mystical directorial debut, The Waterman, out May 7th. This is by Tyler Acalina. For David Oyelowo, working with filmmakers like Steven Spielberg and Ava DuVernay amounted to more than great acting career. It was his film school. The Selma star, 45, had wanted to step behind the camera for years and finally got his shot with The Waterman. Having four kids, I wanted to make something they could watch and love and that my wife and I could watch and enjoy with them, says Oyelowo, whose enthusiasm helped him beat out a major studio for Emma Needle's Blacklist script. The fantastical drama is a conscious throwback to the kind of Spielberg-produced 80s adventure films that Oyelowo grew up loving. It follows an 11-year-old boy named Gunner, played by This Is Us's Lonnie Chavis, on his quest to find the mysterious Waterman, a local legend he believes can save his terminally ill mother, played by Rosario Dawson. It's a film I like to think doesn't patronize the emotional intelligence of children, Oyelowo says. I've watched my own kids navigate things that we sometimes feel the need to protect kids from. Oyelowo drew from his own life to play Gunner's father, Amos, a veteran who struggles to connect with his creative, sensitive son. Being a parent is not an exact science, he notes. Amos is definitely a combination of mistakes and being a good dad. And that emotional honesty is what he strove, above all, to recapture from those 80s movies. They're talking about something that is timeless, Oyelowo says. I'm hoping this film will feel like that for both young people and old. For movies now playing, we have Modern Love. Three provocative new indies explore the beauty and pain of contemporary romance. This is by Leah Greenblatt. We love the ones we're with, but do we ever really know them? That's the eternal question posed by 1,000 songs and self-help cones, and now by several indie dramas due this month to sometimes startling degrees of intimacy. Like its namesake, Monday, on video on demand now. It sets out with all the promise of new beginnings. Athens expats Mickey, played by Avengers Sebastian Stan, and Chloe, played by Irish actress Denise Gow, tumble boozily into bed, or more accurately, beach sand, and then love. It's unlikely from the start. He's a DJ, she's an immigration lawyer, but chemistry and chemicals seem like enough, until they aren't. Director Agiris Papadimitriopoulos from Suntan has a feel for hedonism and atmosphere, and Goff and Stan are extremely game, and for much of it, extremely nude. But the movie also asks us to take on faith that a physical attraction is enough without ever really rooting them in any deeper connection, or delving into why each seems so bent on mutually assured destruction in the first place. Eventually, Mickey begins to tire of the pair's 80-proof Bonnie and Clyde routine. By that point, alas, the story has already slid into a sort of sexified Groundhog Day, amour fou on rise and repeat. If Monday springs from the earliest stages of infatuation, Stellan Skarsgård and Andra Brynn Hoving bring the full weight of romantic history to the Norwegian import Hope, that's also out now. Preoccupied by the daily run delay of kids and careers, their marriage has entered a stage of not entirely benign neglect when Hovig's Anja, a choreographer, discovers that her cancer has returned. How they both reckon with that news and how much each is willing to confront what's fallen away between them forms the quietly profound heart of Maria Sodal's layered, delicate drama, and even for all its lovely Scandinavian gloom, hints at some possibility of truth to the title, too, that title being Hope. David Clayne Crawford and Nikki from The Deuce's Sapita Moafi are navigating their own murky state of estrangement in The Killing of Two Lovers, that's out May 14th, a low-key stunner out of last year's Sundance that makes the most of its micro-budget and stark Utah setting. Wed straight out of high school and now the overtaxed parents of four, they've agreed to a trial separation that includes dating other people, an idea David sees only as a stopgap before he hopes their inevitable reunion, but Nikki embraces. Though the script by writer-director Robert McCohen has a few lumps in it, the film's raw verite style and unforced naturalism do more than set a mood. In its best moments, it breaks your heart. That story was called Modern Love, and it was by Leah Greenblatt. Also in the movies category is something called My Favorite Shot. They call it Oscars edition because this magazine issue has been focused on Oscars, has those big articles. Anyway, Tom Hooper, the filmmaker, revisits a scene on the 10th anniversary of Speech's 4 Oscar wins, including Best Picture and Director. This is as told to Lynette Rice. And the movie that we're talking about here is The King's Speech. It's quite an easy one to answer. It was the first day of the shoot. We did the consulting room scene where the king, played by Colin Firth in his Oscar-winning role, meets Lionel, played by Jeffrey Rush, for the first time. It was a mid-shot where Colin was sitting on the sofa against a blasted-looking wall. There was quite a lot of headroom. Often, as directors, we tend to make the frame invisible. In this light, I thought it'd be interesting to use as a barrier of the frame to be eloquent about the idea of being trapped uncomfortably in the box of the brain. What was exciting to me about Colin was that even though we'd rehearsed for 3 weeks, which is longer than you often get a chance to rehearse, he'd always been quite shy about repeating his stammer in full. I never challenged him about that, like, "Do your stammer," or "Can you just do it to reassure me?" For his own process, he wanted to protect doing out loud until the cameras rolled. So I was literally getting to experience him doing that extraordinary performance in full for the first time. The way it altered his entire physicality and the way he felt trapped in his body, the amount of muscular force and friction in his throat and neck, it was incredibly powerful. And the way he sort of crumbled against the side of the sofa, almost like he's clinging to it like a life raft, that was very lovely to see in that shot. And lastly, the scene played funny, which, again, you can't know until you're doing it. I was lucky that the two actors found the humor within such tremendous pain. Last Saturday, my dad called me to say it was the 10th anniversary of watching you win at the Oscars. I had no idea. I sat next to my mom and dad like 5 rows back at the ceremony. It was very typical and sweet of my parents to remember. I was so pleased they could be there. It's even nicer. They're still around to recollect about it. That was Tom Hooper, as told to Lynette Rice, while he was talking about his movie, The King's Speech. While we're here, why don't I take a quick moment to say that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Entertainment Weekly magazine, and I am reading from the May issue. Our next category, or our next section of the magazine, is called Parental Guidance. Your crib sheet on the best entertainment for kids, from toddlers to tweens. This is by Lacey Verassi-Banis. We have a quick Q&A with Danny McBride. The Righteous Gemstone shines in The Mitchells versus The Machines. That was out on Netflix April 30th, as a Luddite dad trying to save the world and his family. On the surface, The Mitchells versus The Machines is a riotous Black Mirror for kids, but the heart of the film is the relationship between teen Katie, voiced by Abby Jacobson, who's eager to leave the nest, and her dad, Rick Mitchell, who's afraid of being left behind. In a departure from his usual brash roles, dad of two, Danny McBride, 44, voices the gruff but lovable patriarch. And the first question to him is, what drew you to this family film? He says, I'm a fan of what producers Lord and Miller have been behind animation-wise. When Mike, that's Mike Rienda, the director, shared the artwork, the style of it, I thought it was so cool. Then I read the script and saw it was a kid's movie, but it has dramatic moments and there's tons of heart and all the stuff that tends to get a good reaction in this house. Rick and Katie's theme song is T.I. and Rihanna's Live Your Life. Do you have any special songs with your children, Declan 9 and Ava 6? When I used to drive my son to school every morning, we would always listen to We Are the Champions and We Will Rock You. It was like half joking, but it did become a real thing, where it's asked for sometimes if we're going to do stuff that we might be a little nervous about. And the next question is, like all kids, Katie gets embarrassed by her dad. What would yours say is the most embarrassing thing you've ever done? And he says, I'm sure it'll be all the movies I've been in. They just don't realize it yet. That was a Q&A with Danny McBride, and it was by Lacey Verassi Banis. Next, we have guilt-free picks, because your kids have now breached the bathroom and there's nowhere left to hide. For ages 2 and up, Happy Dreams, Little Bunny by Lee Hong. With a gentle narrative and ethereal illustrations perfect for slumber time, Happy Dreams sends little ones on grand adventures all the way to the moon and back. For ages 4 and up, it's Kids Bop All-Time Greatest Hits. After 20 years and 6.5 billion streams, the 4 Kids by Kids brand is a bigger force than many of the artists covered on this album. So, neener neener, whose music isn't cool now? For ages 6 and up, we have Funko Snapsies Mix and Match Surprise Series 1. They have fun snapping and mixing cute creatures together. You get time to mindlessly scroll TikTok. Those are $10 on Amazon.com. And for ages 10 and up, it's Infinity Train on HBO Max. The brilliant sci-fi anthology series returns with its fourth installment, this time featuring a pair of estranged pals who must repair their friendship in order to return home. That was the parental guidance section. And now we're hopping over to TV. First look. Never Have I Ever. The Netflix comedy's second season, premiering this summer, is bringing in the big guns, casting Common as Nalini's, that's played by Poora Jagannathan, love interest. This is by Samantha Highfill. Never Have I Ever met my mom's total smoke show of a love interest? When the hit Netflix comedy Never Have I Ever returns this summer for its highly anticipated second season, hot-headed teen Devi Vishwakumar, played by Maitri Ramakrishnan, won't be the only one trying to figure out her love life. For the first time since losing her tennis-loving dad Mohan, played by Senthil Ramamurthy, she's going to experience what it's like for her rules-loving mom, Nalini, played by Poorna Jagannathan. To date, season one was about saying goodbye, says showrunner Lang Fisher. Both Nalini and Devi have pushed it off and not dealt with their feelings about Mohan dying, and this season it's about moving on. It's about life without him and how to bounce back. Devi will have her hands full with the greatest of storytelling devices, the love triangle. As she tries to choose between hot jock Paxton Hall Yoshida, played by Darren Barnett, and her rival-turned-love interest, Ben Gross, played by Jaron Lewison. As for Nalini, she'll find herself with a rival of her own when fellow dermatologist Dr. Chris Jackson, played by Common, enters the scene. Similar to Devi and Ben's relationship, they sort of start out as competitors, says Fisher. He is a little flashier. He's a real L.A. dermatologist with his own product line. He does a lot of cosmetic work, and his office looks like a spa, whereas Nalini thinks that's undignified for a medical office. But, as often happens, they grow to respect each other, and if they're anything like Devi and Ben, they'll end up kissing in the front seat of a car in no time. Of course, Nalini's dating life isn't nearly as carefree as her teenage daughter's. Not only does Nalini need to think about Devi, but it's not as if she has a well of experience to pull from her own life. Mohan is probably the only person she's ever been with. They got together very young, and I don't think she's ever experienced adult dating, says Fisher. It does catch her by surprise. It's also going to complicate things for her family. After Devi and Nalini initially butted heads in their grief during the first season, they were eventually able to come together to give Mohan a proper goodbye. But with Dr. Jackson's arrival, their relationship status might be more accurately described as it's complicated, or whatever the kids are calling that nowadays. It throws the family into turmoil, says Fisher. It becomes a real chasm between Nalini and Devi because Devi feels like it's a betrayal. With Devi's temper, let's hope Cousin Kamala, played by Risha Murjani, is around to make sure there aren't any heavy textbooks nearby when Debbie discovers her mom's new beau, because even a casting as cool as common isn't going to quell Debbie's rage. And yet it's still an objectively cool casting move, one that started with an email from Andy Samberg, who recorded a voiceover for a season one episode. Andy was like, "Do you know who likes your show is common?" says Fisher. So we reached out and had this Zoom with him, and he was so kind and sweet and effusive about how much he loved Never Have I Ever. Something we definitely have in common. That was Never Have I Ever by Samantha Highfill. License to Thrill. After smashing the charts with Driver's License, Olivia Rodrigo is ready for her High School Musical, the musical, the series character to follow in her footsteps in season two. This is by Sydney Buxbaum. Olivia Rodrigo isn't speeding away from her day job. When her breakout song Driver's License dropped in January, she was filming High School Musical, the series, season two. As her single dominated the charts and broke records, that success didn't change her daily life. It was sort of a strange experience because Driver's License debuted at number one, and it's still number one today, which is crazy. But it was really awesome to be able to go to set and things be totally normal, she tells Entertainment Weekly in March. It helps me keep my head on straight. Showrunner Tim Federle felt a parental pride watching her music career skyrocket overnight. "I don't even know if Olivia realizes how gifted she is," he says of Rodrigo's story writing. It felt inevitable that she was going to become this sensation, with the storytelling of Taylor Swift and the edge of Lorde, and she still shows up to work and knows every line and jokes with the crew and is so sweet to the cast. Rodrigo is hard at work on the follow-up to her hit, but fans will hear her new music first in season two of the Disney Plus series, out May 14th, as Nini and her East High classmates perform Beauty and the Beast. "The success of the music I've put out recently has given me a lot of confidence as a writer and in the other songs that I've written, like the Rose song," she says. "It's this really intricate metaphor, and I've never written a song like that before." The Hopeful song tackles feeling misrepresented, something Rodrigo knows well. "I've always struggled with identity, and that only gets more confusing when you start to introduce boys into the equation, which is what Nini is going through, and what I'm still going through," she says. "It was really important for me to write a song with a message that you're so much more than what the boys think of you. That was something that I actually needed to hear myself at the time." Guess she really did mean what she wrote in that song. That was License to Thrill by Sydney Buxbaum. And so now I'm going to go over to entertainmentweekly.com. Their website is ew.com. And I'm going to read a little bit from that teen article that we were hearing about, the 50 best teen shows of all time. I'll close out our recording today with that article, but I'm sure not going to finish the article today, so we'll have some more of it, and we'll go through the summer together with it. This is by the Entertainment Weekly staff, so it's by everybody, and it says the 50 best teen shows of all time. The teen years are both the best and the worst. You're experiencing so many firsts. First love, first real relationship, first time driving a car, as your whole future sits in front of you. But you're also trying to piece together who you are while feeling all things, navigating the horror that is other teens, and then there's homework. And yet, the same reasons why the teen years are so complicated to live through are why they make for such dramatic, compelling television. To kick off Entertainment Weekly's I Want My Teen TV series, during which we'll bring you new content all summer long, we've ranked the 50 best teen television shows of all time. Before you start telling us all the reasons we're wrong, let us lay out our guidelines for how we defined a teen show. We chose to include shows that prominently feature characters between the ages of 13 and 19, and tackle what we deem as quote-unquote teen issues. That means you'll see a bit of middle school on this list and a bit of college. It also means you'll see shows that focus a lot on parents, such as Friday Night Lights or Gilmore Girls. One thing you won't see? Anything we felt classified more as a family show, with much of the drama taking place inside the family unit and therefore inside the home. Think Seventh Heaven and Blossom. Admittedly, a couple of these shows toe the family show line. We're looking at you, Fresh Prince, and Party of Five, but you'll find all of our reasonings in the blurbs. We'll start with numbers 50 through 40. Number 50, On My Block. This came out on Netflix in 2018. A motley crew of black and brown teens are searching for hidden treasure and themselves in Netflix's On My Block, a much-needed series centering underserved communities whose high school experience is often relegated to the background. At the center of the L.A.-based tale is Mons, played by Sierra Capri, and her crush, Caesar, played by Diego Tinoco, two teens from the same inner-city neighborhood who find love amid gang wars and family trauma. It's definitely not all doom and gloom, especially when fully immersed in their wild adventures, our friends Jamal, played by Brett Gray, Ruby, played by Jason Genau, and Jasmine, played by Jessica Marie Garcia. But a mysterious character named Chivo, played by Emilio Rivera, is often lurking around, and he has homies of his own that rival the teen squad. As literal ceramic gnomes, known as gnomies, it's easy to dismiss them, but it's worth noting how they're never too far away from the mayhem. That was by Rosie Cordero. Number 49 is Skins. This is on E4 from 2007. Skins dared to be bold. Over three generations of characters, the British series provided a new look at the lives of teenagers. It showed viewers a slice of life in Bristol, a grittier tale compared to other stories about young people. Fans will remember when Chris is taken away too soon, Naomi and Emily bravely admitting how they feel about each other, and the many of the show's powerful arcs and moments. Although some had issues with the sex scenes and partying lifestyle displayed, Skins often showed the consequences of risky behavior. What that doesn't take into consideration is the poignant storylines and how well it tackled controversial topics. From bullying to adolescent sexuality, mental illness, and more, Skins never shied away from the subject matter it delved into. In the end, Skins' legacy is in its stars, which includes Daniel Kaluuya, Hannah Murray, Dev Patel, and Jack O'Connell, who went on to have incredible careers. That was by Alamine Johannes. Number 48 is Gidget. That was ABC 1965. Don't be a square. Gidget might be the oldest entry on this list, but making surfing and hanging out at the beach a priority while chasing boys under the golden California sun? With her phone line and lots of sass, Gidget, played by Sally Field, feels just as relatable today as a precocious teen who tries to explain the mysteries of youth to her bewildered dad, played by Don Porter, older sister Anne, played by Betty Connor, and hapless brother-in-law John, played by Pete Duell. Gidget and her father share a real warmth for each other, underpinned by strong performances by both Porter and Field in what would be a star turn early in her career. ABC may have prematurely axed Gidget after one season, but the suits with the roots knew they needed more Sally Field on TV and quickly booked her on the show The Flying Nun, with fewer bikinis and sex teens, as Anne accidentally calls Gidget's beach bum buddies. That was by Sarah Sprague. Number 47 is Big Mouth. This is on Netflix, 2017. This fantastically crass animated series may be populated by hormone monsters, talking pubic hair, and the ghost of Duke Ellington, but its vision of puberty is disarmingly real. Somehow, combining gross-out period jokes and insightful lessons on sexuality, Big Mouth feels a bit like the funniest, filthiest sex ed class you never took. Following preteen friends Nick, voiced by Nick Kroll, Andrew, voiced by John Mulaney, Jesse, voiced by Jesse Klein, and Missy, previously Jenny Slate, now Io Edebiri, as they learn to navigate new relationships and their changing bodies. And in Kroll and Maya Rudolph, as the voices of the aforementioned hormone monsters, and you've got one delightfully gross ode to the weirdness of growing up. That was by Devin Coggan. And it looks like we're just going to be able to get to number 46. This one is Pen 15. That's on Hulu since 2019. Hulu's surreal sitcom was only included in our ranking after much conversation about when precisely a kid becomes a teenager. But that ambiguity cuts to the emotionally delicate core of this seventh grade saga. Co-creators Anna Kunkel and Maya Erskine are grown-up performers playing fictionalized versions of their junior high selves. The characters Anna and Maya are best friends caught together in the nightmare landscape between childhood and adulthood. Crushes, changing bodies, R-rated movies, an oncoming divorce, the lawless mood of up-all-night sleepovers. Millennials can appreciate how Kunkel, Erskine, and fellow co-creator Sam Zblivelman capture every micro detail of Y2K life. But the stunning leads transcend nostalgia and evoke a palpable edge of puberty awkwardness. Pen 15 has a dreamy side, but the performances carry a painful realism. By comparison, even some great shows on this list look like 20-something model mixers. That was by Darren French. Our next entry is number 45. It's Dairy Girls. This is Netflix 2018. Some teen dramas provide a fantasy, a castle-like campus complete with Abercrombie & Fitch model-like students and flashy vehicles like The O.C. and Beverly Hills 90210. Others are steeped in sex, drugs, and general dysfunction. Euphoria. As kids battle against overwhelming odds to make it to graduation, one is unattainably aspirational, the other an important reflection of many people's reality. Dairy Girls falls into neither category and is excellent because it's so universally relatable. Even if you didn't attend Catholic school or grow up with your extended family living in your home. The coming-of-age comedy, set in 90s Derry, North Ireland, follows a group of teen girls and one boy who are refreshingly average. They're curious about sex, insofar as it's something on the periphery that they'll get to. They try to assert their individuality by refusing to wear their blazers to school, and they get excited by pop concerts and fried foods. The show unabashedly explores that in-between part of life that you can't wait to escape because it just seems so torturous at the time, and instead of glorifying it, reveals it for what it truly is. A necessary mess. That was our number 45 entry, Dairy Girls by Ruth Kinane. Number 44, Clone High on MTV 2002. Many teenagers find themselves struggling to live up to their potential, but it makes sense that the problem would be even worse for literal clones of Abraham Lincoln and Mahatma Gandhi. Clone High's inventive premise that the U.S. government secretly cloned every major historical figure they could think of, but then had no idea what to do with these pubescent legends other than stick them in a high school together, made only 13 episodes before the inclusion of Gandhi sparked outrage in India and the animated series was canceled. Even so, that single season survived on YouTube thanks to its absurdist take on teen culture tropes, such as when Spanish conquistador Ponce de Leon pops up for one episode just so he can die and inspire a very special message about the dangers of littering. No wonder creators Phil Lord and Chris Miller from The Lego Movie and Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse went on to expand the possibilities of 21st century animation. That was Clone High by Christian Holub. Number 43 is All American. That was on the CW in 2018. All American brings a myriad of Black experiences to television in a way few shows ever have. Based on the life of NFL player Spencer Paysinger, the drama follows teen athlete Spencer James, played by Daniel Ezra, as he moves from Crenshaw to Beverly Hills to achieve his dreams of playing professional football. Seeing the lives of folks in both Crenshaw and Beverly Hills, separately and when they come together, adds to the spectrum of Black experiences the show can showcase. For example, when Layla Keating, played by Greta Onyegu, is coming to terms with her depression, the show spends a season deeply exploring her struggle. All American also tackles topics including gang violence and teen pregnancy. Plus, it's fun. We'll never forget the Black Cotillion. While balancing the joy and stark realities of being Black in America, the drama has been doing the inclusive storytelling that many hope to see more of. That was All America, and it was by Alamine Johannes. Number 42, Welcome Back, Cotter, ABC 1975. First airing in the late 70s, and then garnering new pupils in syndication, Welcome Back, Cotter was a celebration of mediocre students and the teachers saddled with them. Mr. Cotter, played by Gabe Kaplan, gets his name in the sitcom title as the beleaguered educator working at his old high school, but the sweat hogs, the group of lovable delinquents who give him a hard time and occasionally learn something, are the real heads of the class. Leading that pack is a young John Travolta as sweat hog in chief, Vinnie Barbarino, the role that would launch his career seated amongst classmates that reflect the show's diverse Brooklyn setting, among them Lawrence Hilton Jacobs' Freddie Boom Boom Washington and Robert Higgins' Juan Epstein. In addition to Travolta, the series' four-year run also gave viewers the unforgettable voice of nerdy, naive Arnold Horshack, played by Ron Palillo, made John Sebastian's Welcome Back theme a hit and brought forth the insult, up your nose with a rubber hose, which deserves full marks in its own right. That was number 42, Welcome Back, Cotter, and that was by Jessica Dershowitz. And number 41, Pretty Little Liars, ABC, Family, and Freeform, 2010. Following behind Gossip Girl, Pretty Little Liars took the teen mystery to the next level. Based on Sarah Shepard's book series, Pretty Little Liars follows high school best friends Aria, played by Lucy Hale, and Spencer, played by Troy Belisario, Emily, played by Shay Mitchell, and Hannah, played by Ashley Benson, as they deal with the disappearance of their other bestie, mean girl Allison DeLaurentis, played by Sasha Peteris, and her yellow tank top. But when the girls start receiving mysterious text messages from an anonymous sender, the question becomes, is Allison actually dead? The series, which revolutionized using social media to interact with a fandom, delivered countless shocking twists and multiple major reveals, including more than one A in its seven seasons. And although its later seasons lost some of the spark of the original mystery, its impressive run earns it a place on this list. That was number 41, Pretty Little Liars, and it was by Samantha Highfill. And that's where we'll stop on our teen show list, and where we'll stop for the show this week. Thanks for listening. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Please come back next week. I'll read more from the May issue of Entertainment Weekly, and I'll come back to our 50 best teen shows of all time. Until then, goodbye.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American at 3. On this week's Texas Monthly Archives, we're reading articles featuring the world-famous Chicken Ranch. So we're following in that same theme with our audio-described movie, Saturday Night.
Texas has a whorehouse in it.
The hospitality and friendliness never changed.